The overture Poet and Peasant by Franz von Suppe, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, was conducted by Paul Perret. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. Thank you so much for your company. Next week, I have a really stunning performance of Mozart's Linz Symphony. Aspects of Prayer fill my musical middle hour, and from 10 till 11. And as for the Bach cello suites, Pierre Fournier and Anna Bilsma do the honours. So please do join me, same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this week by Neil Miners.
On The Choir today on BBC Radio 3, I'm looking at the world of choral societies with the help of Richard Cook and Ronald Corp. The film composer Debbie Wiseman shares some of her choral favourites and another choral classic, Elgar's Dream of Gerontius. Join me, Sarah Moore-Peach, for The Choir this afternoon at 4 o'clock on Radio 3.
Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. This has been Sunday Morning with me, Rob Cowan. But now it's just past midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. His guest, Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen is one of the most gifted actors of his generation and certainly one of the most versatile. For many of us, he's best known for playing real people, most famously Tony Blair, three times. But as well as Blair, he's portrayed Brian Clough, Kenneth Williams and David Frost, and recently he's appeared on television as the pioneering sex researcher William Masters in Masters of Sex, for which he received a Golden Globe nomination. An acclaimed stage actor, he's played everyone from Hamlet to Caligula, and on the big screen he's appeared in films as varied as Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris and the blockbuster series Twilight. He lives in LA now, but I'm happy, Michael, to be able to catch you on a visit back home to see your family, which I guess means Wales.
Yes, Port Talbot, yeah, it's always lovely to get back there.
Did you find when you were young and just starting that acting for you came quite naturally, that you had an ability to get inside the skin of the characters you were looking at?
Well, I've thought a lot about, you know, how it all started. And it was just something that I realised worked in my family, you know, that I got sort of points for if you could, at family gatherings, if you could get up and do a little something or sing a song or perform in some way. Looking back now, I had an auntie. And she, at Christmas, would disappear for a little while at family gatherings. Her name was Marion. And you wouldn't know where Marion had gone. And then suddenly Marion would reappear in this character that she had created. And she would take her teeth out and then put some weird outfit on and put something on a hat, a particular hat I remember she used to wear. And she'd come in and then she'd talk about how she'd come down on the lorries. And you can imagine, no teeth in. She'd be going, I come down on the lorries. And she used to do this character. The first time I ever noticed this happening, I was so freaked out by it. It seemed like such a surreal experience. And then this was just what Marion did. She just did this character. So you can tell that there was a kind of a currency to doing some sort of performance. And I think I picked up on that fairly early. And also a lot of my family did sort of amateur operatics and that. So it was musicals, really, that I got brought up on, the kind of classic musicals, the Carousel and that kind of stuff, and the Gilbert and Sullivan shows as well.
This first piece has actually a strong dramatic element to it, the first piece you've chosen, the Mozart, doesn't it?
Well, it was a big turning point for me, I suppose, in my career, when I played Mozart in Amadeus. Peter Schaffer's playing, David Suchet played Salieri. And I played Mozart. And so that was my first, I suppose, real exposure to classical music in general, and certainly Mozart. And listening to the music, it sort of had a profound effect on me, actually.
Thank you.
in the production when we did Amadeus, my daughter was nearly upon us at that point. My partner, Kate, at the time was pregnant with my daughter, Lily. And so there was a lot of talk of the Mozart effect, you know, on babies while still in the womb. And if they listen, if they hear Mozart, this has a very positive effect, apparently. So they were the sort of perfect conditions for creating this perfect child, which we ended up having. And Kate used to sit in the dressing room at the Old Vic whilst I was performing, and you just hear this Mozart music everywhere.
That's Kate Beckinsale. She was...
Yes.
Well-known actress of the world.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And so in fact, when my daughter was born, I was hoping she would be born and I could get the night off the show. in fact, like a good theatre baby, she was born on a Sunday when we weren't performing. And then after the show on the Monday night, when I came back, David Suchet at the curtain call stopped the audience from clapping and announced the birth of our child, who didn't have a name at the time. And the sound lady who was at the back of the theatre, recorded it. So I've got the announcement of the birth of the Sheen baby, as she was known at that point.
Music from Mozart's Requiem in D minor. We heard the Vienna Singverein and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Herbert von Karajan. I can imagine that with a figure like Mozart, you bring something of yourself to somebody you've not met, but I think you probably bring something of yourself even to people who are still alive, don't you?
I think especially so, yeah. In a way. I mean, all the people I've played who are real people, the work that goes into it beforehand is all about trying to find the point of connection. Because ultimately, I'm always playing myself. Oscar Wilde said, you give a man a mask and he'll show you his true face.
And it's a wonderful, insightful comment. Yeah.
So, you know, playing someone like Blair or Kenneth Williams or Brian Clough or David Frost or whoever it might be, in some ways you get to reveal even more of yourself. Or at least that's certainly the challenge, I think, is that you have to find an emotional, psychological connection with that character, which in some ways is easier to do with a fictional character because you don't have the finished product somehow walking around for people to look at. You know, everyone knows what I'm supposed to look like or sound like if I'm playing Blair or Frost or whatever. But at the same time, so that it's not just an impersonation, so you're not just playing the externals. You know, it's the difference between doing a sketch or an impersonation or something which only lasts a very short amount of time. If you're taking an audience on a journey with the character, then you want to be drawing attention to the internal aspects of the character, not the externals. So it's a difficult balancing act, but ultimately I feel like it's all about finding a way to play yourself through whoever the character is.
The next piece has been written specifically for film, which is interesting. Why do you particularly like it?
This is by a woman called Lisa Gerrard, who's an Australian musician, singer. And she did a lot of amazing work on the soundtrack of Gladiator. So a lot of people will have heard her music. When I heard this actual piece of music, which I think was used for the first time in the film of The Insider, it just had such a profound effect on me. I mean, almost a physical effect on me. It reduces me to tears a lot. It's sort of soaring music. It's got a kind of religious, mystical aspect to it, I think, in some ways. I find it really, really, really powerful. a lot of music is so powerful because it kind of somehow bypasses your conscious mind in some ways and goes straight into a more emotive, instinctive place. There are times, therefore, when I want to be in a creative mode somehow. And so there's certain pieces of music or certain artists that I'll listen to, and one is Lisa Gerrard.
That was Sacrifice, composed and performed by Lisa Gerrard and Peter Burke, from the soundtrack to the 1999 film The Insider. Michael Sheen, you were born in Newport, South Wales, moved to Liverpool for 3 years, I think, and then back to Wales when you were about eight, to Port Talbot, your mother's hometown. What sort of place was it to grow up in?
Well, it was interesting because, yes, my family all come from Port Talbot and had done for years and years and years, but I didn't get there until I was 8 years old. So I always slightly felt like an outsider there, and yet it was my home. So it set up an interesting relationship for me. It was quite a frightening place. I mean, I remember literally having to fight my way out of other schools. We would go and play rugby or football or whatever against another school, and oftentimes we'd have to walk home. And it was a violent place. It was scary. And you had to sort of learn how to look after yourself. And there was always a sense of kind of latent violence around. And I remember when I came to do my second ever theatre job, which was Romeo and Juliet. And as I read Romeo and Juliet, I instantly recognised the place.
Montagues and Capulets.
Yeah, this is the place I grew up in. And that was a big thing for me to come in to do a play like Romeo and Juliet, a Shakespeare play, with such a personal sense of meaning to it.
So interesting, from a very early age, that sort of search for identity.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, from the very beginning.
Have you always turned to music for moments when you want something else from the world, as it were?
I have. Music has always been a very big part of my life. Interestingly, my parents never really listened to music when I was growing up. My dad does love the Italian tenors and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I can't ever remember really growing up listening to music in the house or my parents listening to music. But my mum started working for Sony, the factory in Bridgend nearby, where they made the cassette cases back in the days of cassettes, Michael. And so as a sort of perk for working in that place, she got to bring home quite a bit of music. They got it free, really. I remember, you know, getting bizarre kind of jazz, funk, classical fusions that I'd never heard of, just to experiment, really. And I used to spend a lot of time reading and on my own, and had a very kind of rich, imaginative world, I suppose. And I think music started to feed into that. I started listening to the radio a lot.
In fact, that's a rather opportune moment to talk about the next piece, because actually you, I think, discovered a record collection of yours quite recently and came back again to this piece.
Yes, I have a lot of things in storage around. I did for a long time in all kinds of places around the world. Now it's just in Wales. But I went to the storage place in Wales about a year ago and came across my very first record collection, these singles, these 45 RPMs, from, I guess, the late 70s, early 80s. And then in amongst them, I discover this single by someone called Laurie Anderson, who is a New York-based performance artist, really, was married to Lou Reed. And she, I guess, must have released this song as a single around sort of 1980, I suppose.
Yeah, 1981.
Right. And how on earth I came across it. I would have been 11, 12.
Well, it did get to number 2 in the UK charts.
Ah, well, then that's how I heard it. I mean, you'll hear it now, but it's a very peculiar piece of music. But I've come over the years to think it's an extraordinary piece of music.
But it's particularly apposite for us, Michael, because she was inspired by Massenet's opera of 1885, Le Cid. And so it's a kind of really off-the-wall cover version.
How extraordinary. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, listen to it again now.
Okay.
And see if that enlightens you in any way at all.
Okay.
Superman. pajama. Just start talking at the sound of the tone. Hello? This is your mother. Are you there? Are you coming home? Okay, who is this really? And the voice said, this is the hand that takes. This is the hand.
Hypnotic, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. It's such a sort of epic canvas that she's sort of working on. I find it very disturbing. Things like, because that idea of someone calling you up on the telephone and saying, "You don't know me, but I know you," and then saying, "I am the narrator," I suppose, says, "But who is this really?" Say, "I am the hand that takes," and then saying, "Here come the planes," and you know, it's obviously pre-9/11 when she wrote it, but it makes me think of that. And they're American planes. I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. I really do.
Well, the first lines you see, "O Superman, O Judge, O Mom and Dad," echo a line in Massenet. I mean, it is an extraordinary departure, which are "O Souverain, O Sovereign, O Juge, O Judge, O Père, O Father." Mm. Laurie Anderson singing her 1981 composition, "O Superman," for Massenet from the album Big Science. Now, Mike Sheen, we're going to hear Richard Burton in a moment, and it is extraordinary that Port Talbot should have produced Richard Burton, Anthony Hopkins and you, and I can't help wondering whether they've been an influence, whether you thought, well, you know, they came from the same modest background and look what they've done.
Yeah. The Port Talbot of Richard Burton's time is very different to the Port Talbot of my time. But I do know that, you know, I've spoken to Tony Hopkins about this a little bit, and, you know, he was very much influenced by the fact that Burton came from that town. Because of the legacy of Burton, Burton had made it all right to do that, that it was a noble pursuit. He was a man who came from good mining stock. He was a man's man. And I think that kind of dark energy that is there in Burton, certainly there in Hopkins as well. I feel it's there in me as well, that there's an outlet for it. You know, I think Burton would probably say the same thing, and I know Tony has said it, is that if they hadn't got into acting, a little bit scared of what they would have got into. And they certainly got into enough anyway, even being actors. But I think that's true, is that there's an outlet for that thing. And as the explosion that happened in the 50s, I suppose, with around Look Back in Anger, where suddenly regional voices, you know, people who weren't coming and being the natural RP actors, suddenly you had voices and personalities, Albert Finney doing Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. And our artistic life, our cultural life in this country depends on people not just coming from one particular type of background and one particular type of family. That our cultural life depends on people being supported and being allowed to find a way into it. And that is just disappearing. I mean, my school, the comprehensive school I went to, no longer has a drama department. The youth theatre has just had its funding cut. I simply wouldn't have done what I've done if I was trying to do it now. It just wouldn't happen.
What are we going to hear Richard Burton doing?
Well, we're going to hear, I think I was thinking about this, and I think this is probably the first time I ever heard, in quotation marks, classical music, and kind of was thrilled by it. This is from Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, which is not a classical music piece necessarily, but the opening of it begins with Richard Burton and that voice, the last years of the 19th century, doing this sort of speech from H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And then it goes into a piece of music that is called Eve of the War. And the opening sort of chords of it had a huge effect on me, actually, and opened up, just as a concept, the idea that I could find an orchestra playing music as viscerally thrilling and exciting as I could hearing Jimi Hendrix playing guitar, or, you know, a heavy metal band, or whatever it might, Led Zeppelin playing Kashmir, or something that just excited me so much. And for the very first time, the opening of this piece of music did that to me as well.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
Thank you.
I know every single note and every single sound and every single word of that entire double album. And there was a period of time where I was playing Caligula on stage at the Donmar Theatre in London in the nights, and in the days I was filming the very first time I played Tony Blair in the TV film The Deal. And so I was filming all day. I'd be getting up at about 5 a.m. and then filming all day, and then there would be a motorbike waiting for me. I'd run off the set, get on the back of the motorbike. The motorbike would whiz me across London to the theatre. I'd get off the back of the motorbike, get into the dressing room, get changed, go on and do Caligula, and I'd finish at about, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night. You know, it takes a while to sort of come down from doing that, so I wouldn't get to sleep till about 1, and then I'd be up at 5 again. And on the days off from the theatre, I had to film all day, and the days off from the film, I was performing all day. So I had no time off at all for about 5-6 weeks, and I was literally exhausted. And I would come into the theatre sometimes, and I was so exhausted that I would, but I was sort of working off nervous energy, and I would go into the little toilet cubicle at the theatre, and I would sit and shake and cry for about 2 minutes, not because I was upset, but it was just a sort of nervous energy thing. Then I go into the dressing room, which we all shared, the whole cast, the male cast in one room, and then in order to get myself worked up to do the play, I would perform as much of War of the Worlds, the music, doing all the instruments myself and all the words, and I'm sure everyone in the cast got so bored and upset and annoyed with me, but I would do it.
I couldn't help having a rather wonderful, surreal, Python-esque vision of you beginning to mix up the lines of Caligula and Tony Blair. Music from The Eve of War, from Jeff and Doreen Wayne's musical retelling of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds. We heard Richard Burton, of course, reading the part of the journalist. Actually, of course, it was closer to classical than I think possibly we gave it credit for, because clearly based on the opening of the famous Beethoven symphony.
Undoubtedly.
Ba-ba-ba-bum.
Yeah. Undoubtedly he was going for something of that kind of monumental power.
And by the way, you can find details of all of Michael Sheen's choices on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You returned to Port Talbot for Easter 2011 to direct and star in an extraordinary and monumental work, Marathon 72-hour passion play with a cast of, I think it's about 1,000 local people. Huge commitment. What drove you to this?
I suppose the major trigger was that I was asked if I would do something for the newly established National Theatre Wales. They said, look, what we're really interested in doing in our first season is to do something that is, to do productions that are much more connected to the community, the local community, and to kind of experiment a bit more with the relationship between the audience and the material and maybe not be in theatres, maybe do things that are a bit more site-specific. And I immediately started remembering the passion play that I used to go to see in a local park in my town. And it wasn't necessarily that I'm not religious in that respect. I'm not part of an actual religion. But it had a profound effect on me, I think, partly because it was outdoors. We saw it in a park. And also because it was local community members. It wasn't professional actors. It was, you just saw old people and children, everyone getting involved. And then, of course, the story is an incredibly powerful story. And I think since then, since I was a child growing up in Port Talbot, I've been kind of, I suppose, really, there's no two ways about it. I've been obsessed by the story of Jesus, even though I'm not a Christian. I wouldn't describe myself as a Christian. But I'm obsessed by that story. The iconography of it, I don't know. I suppose it's a story that is hardwired into the Western mind, whether you describe yourself as Christian or not. I think there's a very famous phrase that has stuck in my mind. I can't even remember who said it, but who said that we live in a Christ-haunted world. I'm certainly a Christ-haunted person. And so coming from this place, Port Talbot, which is sort of mythic in my mind, and it's very visual. I mean, Terry Gilliam got the idea for doing the film of Brazil from visiting Port Talbot, he told me. And it's a place that has a lot of challenges. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of people with all kinds of illnesses and living with disabilities, and has a very high suicide rate. There's a lot of depressing aspects to it. And yet, it's an extraordinary place because of all those challenges, there are people who are making that community work every day with no money, no support. And so I was very inspired by that the story of the passion, the story of Christ, of the sacrifice, of the death and rebirth, for me, was symbolized nowadays for me by the sense of community. And so I wanted to do something that celebrated a particular specific town at this time. It wasn't a story about something that happened 2,000 years ago. It's now this town, but using the sort of template, if you want, of the story of the Passion that everyone can orientate themselves within. If you're watching it, you know, oh, this is the Last Supper, this is the crucifixion. But actually, it's a story about the town.
And curiously enough, a piece that you came to love at that time is Arvo Pärt's Cantus in Memoriam Benjamin Britten, which actually simply, when one analyzes it, is a descending scale, but done in an incredibly beautiful, growing out of silence and using bells. I can see why that might have been attractive to you at that time.
It's interesting you should say that, because I could have chosen every piece by Arvo Pärt on this programme. And I came across his music for the first time whilst I was working on The Passion. And I think you're absolutely right. His idea of taking something that is essentially very simple in its form and finding a way to let the transcendent come through that is exactly what I was trying to do with The Passion. And I think what Arvo Pärt is extraordinary about doing, certainly during this period, during the Tintinnabuli period or whatever, with things like Spiegel im Spiegel and the piece that we're going to hear, is that you take something apparently on the surface very simple, and yet something extraordinarily monumental is able to kind of shine through it. I was fascinated to find out that Benjamin Britten died in 76 and that piece was written in 77, which in Britain was the explosion of punk, that the Sex Pistols brought out their sort of seminal album in 77, and that was the high point of this explosion of kind of anarchic, freeing energy that happened in the country. And when I listened to that piece of music by Arvo Pärt, as it builds and builds and that sort of tintinnabuly bell-like thing coming in and growing and growing. And I remember the first time hearing it thinking, it can't keep going. This is too much. It's too overwhelming. And it's similar that it has a kind of a punk spirit to it almost. It threatens to overwhelm you and just kind of explode everything somehow. There's that kind of annihilation of death that it's celebrating, I suppose, in one sense. It's very similar to punk, it seems to me.
Beautiful piece. Cantus in Memoriam Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt. We heard the Estonian National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Paavo Järvi. Michael Sheen, we've talked a lot about your hometown, Port Talbot, but of course you're now based in LA.
The concept of home has become a very complicated concept for me. I left Port Talbot when I was 18 to go to drama school, came to London, and it was only really when I came to London that I realised I was Welsh, because in the same way as I always think of, you know, fish don't realise they're wet until they come out of the water. And then at a certain point, I left London and went to America. I've never fully felt like I really belong in Los Angeles, certainly. I live there because my daughter's there and I've made a home for myself there, but it certainly doesn't feel like home. And yet when I come back to Wales, to Port Talbot, it's, even though it's home in one way, I don't feel like I truly belong there anymore, you know. So now I don't really have a place that's like home. I suppose people become home after a certain time, or certain experiences. I think that's where music becomes very important. There's a T.S. Eliot quote from The Wasteland, I think, where he says, "These fragments I have shored against my ruins," and that's always resonated for me. The idea that somehow you pick things up along the way, you know, in life, little quotes or little poems or pieces of music or things that people have said or memories or whatever it might be. And those fragments become what shore you up against your own ruin, is what keeps you from, you know, going into the dark somehow. And that has become very much my sort of home now, is music.
Do you listen to music while you're actually learning lines?
I do. I listen to music, like I said earlier, you know, listening to certain kinds of music seems to make me more kind of either creative or more receptive or more open to ideas. And so there are certain kinds of music that I can listen to. Also, as I've spent the last year or so starting to write my own things now, there's certain music I can listen to and certain music I can't. And you start to find, oh, this is the music for this project, or this is the music that helps me here. But if it's something that has too many words or is almost too surface interesting, then it can stop you from getting on with what you're doing, you know. But if you find things that actually just kind of create a sort of fertile bedrock, then they become very useful.
Do you want to move more into script writing and perhaps directing?
Yeah, I think the projects, like we talked about with the passion, once you've done something like that, it becomes very difficult to become an actor for hire, you know. That had such personal meaning for me. And I was acting with my mother and father and my old teachers and people I was at school with, and, you know, and about a story about my town, and a lot of my own personal kind of myth was in it. And then I did Hamlet, which again was an incredibly personal project for me as well, and I worked on both of those for about 2 or 3 years before we actually did them. So it became a natural progression, really, to think about, well, now I'm going to write my own scripts and I'm going to develop my own projects. And Masters of Sex, I'm a producer on, and I have a lot of personal involvement in the storylines and the writing of it and where it's going and what it's about. And so I think that is definitely the way forward for me now.
Given what you've said about how much you are a sucker, if you like, for music that has a kind of repetitive, even if ever slightly changing, aspect to it, and that it kind of gets to you, I'm not surprised by this next choice, which is?
Well, it is by Philip Glass, called Facades. I first really got interested in Philip Glass because there was a film made of The Passion, which was called The Gospel of Us, and it was made by a wonderful man called Dave McKean. And watching his film, what he did with it, there's these extraordinary images going on in the town. His use of Philip Glass's music somehow was the perfect choice to get a sense of something growing, something, again, both simple on the surface, but allowing something much deeper to come through over time, through repetition and familiarity.
There's quite a big Philip Glass festival coming up in Los Angeles in the next few months.
There is, and I've booked my tickets because I've never actually been able to hear the music live, and so I'm going to be having my own Glass Fest this year.
Take a cushion.
Mm.
We heard Facades from Philip Glass's 1981 composition, Glassworks. Do you actually play an instrument at all? Or?
I don't. When I was younger, I started to learn to play the trumpet. I got into a youth orchestra, I suppose, with a brass section, and the trumpet only played a couple of notes every 10 minutes, and I just couldn't follow the music for that long. I got so bored, and so I stopped doing that. But it did come in handy when I played Jimmy Porter in Look Back in Anger, where I started the production by playing some jazz trumpet at the beginning. So I'd learnt enough to be able to get away with that.
And have you had to sing?
I just did a film, actually, funnily enough, last year, Far From the Madding Crowd.
Oh, it's a remake, is it?
Yeah, and in that, me and Kerry Mulligan, who plays Bathsheba, we sing a song in that. So that will be the first time on film, I think, that I've ever sung.
What, a kind of folk song?
A folk song, yeah. She has a beautiful singing voice, so I just sort of ride on her shirt tails, really.
Well, we're going to end with Joan Jean Renault, and I'm interested in how you came by this.
Now, she is a cellist who was with the Kronos Quartet, I believe, until 1999, and then started doing solo work. And the piece I find very powerful. The beginning of it is it has a sense of kind of magic and something imminent. Again, she's someone who obviously is a cellist, but also plays with electronic elements in her music. And this somehow brings those two things together beautifully, I think.
It's called Song of Songs, and it's from Metamorphosis. And I suppose if there's one Metamorphosis that you would have enjoyed, and it nearly happened, is that you might have been a professional footballer.
That's right, yeah, before...
Because you were pretty good in the Brian Clough film.
Thank you very much. Well,
United.
Yeah, that was the first time that those two sides of my life were able to come together, really. All I was obsessed by was football when I was growing up until about the age of... I suppose until really I was about 14, and when I was in the youth theatre, and that really started to have an effect on me. But up until then, every waking hour was spent playing football, even on my own. I would go back to the schoolyard after school had finished and just play football on my own up against a wall. I was absolutely obsessed by it.
Well, with that thought in mind, we'll leave you with Joan Jeanrenaud and Song of Songs. And may I thank you, Michael Sheen, very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. The Song of Songs by Karen Tanaka, performed by Joan Jean Renault. Details of all of Michael Sheen's music choices are on the Private Passions page of the BBC Radio 3 website, where you can also download the programme to keep. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Jane Greenwood. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3, and next week at the same time, Michael's guest is the cook, Ruth Rogers.
The Winter Olympics on the BBC.
I am the bitter rival, the fearsome force you'll blame. I will thwart your every hope. Nature is my name. I am the dire torment, the tingle up your spine. Now cast away all pleasantries. It's time to see who'll shine.
Nature, who will conquer it? The Winter Olympics start on Friday, the 7th of February, across the BBC.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Sunday here on BBC Radio 3. Music for string quartet in our lunchtime concert in a couple of minutes, then music by the 13th century composer Perrotin in the early music show at 2 o'clock. And that's followed at 3 by another chance to hear last Wednesday's service of choral evensong from the chapel of King's College, Cambridge. Now it's coming up to 2 minutes past one, and here's the latest BBC news. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, has insisted that Labour is on the side of businesses, despite a backlash over its plans to reinstate the 50 pence tax rate. Some business leaders suggest the policy could jeopardise the economic recovery. This morning, Mr Balls ruled out any further increase under Labour to a 60 pence top rate of tax. The Chief Inspector of Schools in England has said he is spitting blood over criticism of Ofsted, which he believes has come from inside the government. Sir Michael Wilshaw says he won't be intimidated by critical reports written by two policy groups. Opposition groups in Ukraine have vowed to continue their protests demanding new elections, despite being offered senior jobs in the government. The leader of Ukraine's Fatherland Party rejected the offer, saying it was up to the people to choose leaders, not the presidency. Representatives from both sides in Syria's civil war are continuing to take part in UN-sponsored peace talks in Geneva today. Here, the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, says the government is working on plans to help the most vulnerable Syrians leave the region and will make an announcement in the coming days. A leader of Thailand's anti-government protest movement has been shot dead. Suthin Tharatin was speaking at a rally in Bangkok designed to disrupt early voting in the country's general election. The protesters are calling for the family of the Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawat, to be removed from power. Anti-smoking campaigners have welcomed the government's plan to introduce new laws, making it illegal for under-18s to buy electronic cigarettes. Any adult who buys real cigarettes for children will also be prosecuted. A climber has survived a 200-foot fall in the Cairngorms. Rescue teams say he suffered only a broken ankle, largely because there'd been so much snow, which cushioned his fall. And the weather. Heavy rain and strong winds will sweep eastwards across the country. The north and west will have gales. Sunshine and blustery showers will follow. Temperatures will range from 4 degrees Celsius in Belfast to 10 in London. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at exactly 4 minutes past one. So looking ahead to later this afternoon, Sarah Moore-Peach is here with this week's edition of The Choir. That's at 4 o'clock. We've words and music inspired by the colour blue at 5:30. Our Sunday feature with Rana Mitter visits Shanghai World City Redux at 6:45 this evening. And then at 7:30, our live Sunday evening concert is a song recital from the Wigmore Hall. The bass baritone Luca Pizzaroni, accompanied by Wolfram Rieger, songs by Beethoven, Reichardt, Brahms and Liszt. That's tonight at 7:30. But before all that, here on BBC Radio 3, today's lunchtime concert, which was given at the 2011 City of London Festival by the Escher Quartet, when they were members of the Radio 3 New Generation Artists Scheme. The festival's focus in the summer of 2011 was on Australia, New Zealand and the South Pacific, and this recital by the Escher Quartet includes a work by the Australian composer and viola player Brett Dean called Eclipse. You can hear that in just under 25 minutes. But the concert begins with Haydn. He'd visited London several times when, in 1797, he wrote this Evocation of Dawn. Here's Haydn's string quartet in B-flat, opus 76, number 4, known as The Sunrise.
Thank you.